Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
Achtung, Achtung, attenzione, attenzione. Double bubble from the Axis men, this main men this morning. 80 years ago, welcome, by the way, to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. Of course, 80 years ago this week, both Mussolini and Hitler gave speeches to their people with updates on the war effort. Il Duce admitted that Italy had experienced some grey days, but reassured Italians the final result will be an Axis victory. Yeah, but, That's funny, isn't it? Not an Italian victory. He's going, maybe not us that wins it.
Yeah, not on our own.
Not on our own. Hitler was more businesslike and menacing. 21 years after the founding of the Nazi Party, he promised that the U-boat offensive would be accelerated in the spring. Well, and on that cheery note, like I said, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. How are you, James?
Yeah, no, I'm all right, thank you. How was your weekend? I saw a very interesting conversation about jesters on WhatsApp last night. I sat down for my tea. You know, it's got up again. There were sort of 25 messages about fools and jesters. And
yeah, I'm being roped into your brother's hit podcast. The rest is history. And I've got they want me
the
to talk about comedy.
Smash Hit History Podcast.
And I know a little bit about the history of... Yes, Smash Hit History Podcast. I know a little bit about jesters. And he'll like it because it's all to do with Christian theology. So he'll be able to plug his bloody book again.
Oh, my God. He's relentless, isn't he? He's much worse than you or I on plugging books.
He's a machine.
Certainly worse than me. Yeah, and he's shameless. Absolutely shameless. Anyway. But it sounds anyway. Like, from listening to some of them, it sounds like Dominic Sandbrook has got the measure of him. With relentless piss-taking.
The Hallie Rubenhold one about sex, which was in the 18th and 19th century, which was fascinating.
Well, I've got that little treat ahead of me. They did a brilliant one on Pompeii with Sophie Hay, who actually we should get on because I was talking to her about doing a doc actually about the bombing of Pompeii in the war, which is a really, really interesting episode because the curator of Pompeii at the time was a fascist, but actually he saved Pompeii. So he was a good fascist.
Right.
And
it's wow, steady.
Ish. He was a good fascist if you like your classics and you like your ancient Roman buildings and towns.
A fascist being a specialist in ruins is quite something, isn't it? I mean, that's where it always ends
well,
up.
Well, they always like the new stuff, don't they? Well, you're absolutely right. It does all end in ruins. It all ends in tears, but not at Pompeii, it would seem. So anyway, she'd be good on that. But also, they did a brilliant one on the 17th century. But anyway, we digress. We're not here to talk about the 17th century.
I'm going to be on that shortly. Anyway, by the way, thanks everyone. At the weekend, we ran a Twitter World Cup of War films that culminated at the weekend, and it got out of hand on Saturday.
That was
during
good fun,
final
though,
voting. It was great fun. There was a brief moment where I felt the need to shout "Stop the steal" as James piled pressure on voters by appearing on Twitter in flying goggles, exhorting them to support the Battle of Britain. Of course. At the end, the vote was mighty close, and the cursed numbers, the Brexit ratio.
but also 52% in favour of Britain, 48% in favour of Europe. I suddenly felt a little bit embarrassed, if I'm honest.
Literally. The cursed numbers. Those numbers are going to follow us all to our graves. Absolutely everything from now on is going to pan out on those numbers. Anyway,
but I should say that my two favourite war films didn't even make the cut.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was a fair bit. It was quite interesting. You get these on Twitter, you get these people when you see those polls run who come to the final, the last one, go, "How has it ended up on these two?" And you think, well, look at the heats.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd stepped in earlier,
if you started earlier, the whole thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Maybe we would be arguing about Das Boot, but
a lot of people
there,
voted, didn't they? Jesus.
They did. Yeah, it's very sweet. To see seeing engagement like that, to see a part of the conversation. Very nice. one quick bit of business though. We are planning, and of course, we're recording this today on Monday, as you know, on the 22nd, as rumours of whatever the next phase of the next phase of the latest phase of the next phase of our lockdown exit or not are to be. So September, we're gambling on 7 months from now as a possible option. But we are planning to have a We Have Ways festival. I know, 7 months away.
It's got to be okay by then, surely.
It's the best we can offer. A We Have Ways festival in September, Friday the 17th to Sunday the 19th, which some of you have noted is, of course, the weekend of the Arnhem commemorations. But you might not be able to leave the country. So it may be that your best bet will be that We Have Ways Fest. We haven't, I don't know if we, have we got a name for it yet?
I quite like
Warstock. What are we going to?
Warstock.
Warstonbury. What are we going to call it?
Well, I think it'll have an official name, then it'll have an in-house name.
Yeah,
it'll have
an in-house name.
I think
nickname,
it's probably absolutely. We Have Ways Fest.
Yeah, yeah.
A Warstful. No, that doesn't work, does it?
It doesn't really work. We'll probably have and there'll be a bar, an operational bar, a tactical bar, a strategic bar.
And a bureaucratic bar. I mean,
we don't know. Yeah, a bureaucratic bar, absolutely. We don't know where this will be held quite yet. Last week, we had some loose lips that nearly sunk a ship. We don't quite know where it'll be held yet, but we are knitting it all together.
We're homing in.
We're homing in on it. We're trying to sort it all out. More info as soon as we do. But please, keep the dates in your diary. Now,
I think it's also fair to say that even though it is on the 17th, 18th and 19th of September, I suspect there will be a fair nod to Market Garden at the,
possible.
At the We Have Ways Fest.
I think possibly. And we're lining up all your favourite speakers and characters and people who've made this whole thing. And tanks, of course, that made this whole thing so much fun the last year or so as we approach a whole year of lockdown. I think I'm going to cut my hair off when the actual anniversary of the first lockdown comes around. I think I'm going to go back to year zero.
Yeah, I can't wait for this festival, though. I really can't. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, and meeting a lot of the regular listeners and characters who've tickled us along, and the fellow afflicted, the patrons, Jimmy Bagpuss, Andy Aitchison.
All those people. Yeah, all
absolutely,
the
yeah. Now, last week, was it last week or the week before? We had a question, didn't we, about what's a battalion, what's a division
and all that.
Yes. Now, I am at the moment reading another audiobook, getting ahead. We're laying down some long-term audiobooks. And at the moment on the Patreon, there's the Molly Panther Downs. I think people are enjoying which her memoirs of war memoirs of her experiences of being a civilian in London during the Second World War. Anyway, but we talked about divisions and all that. And I'm reading the Mackie Steinhoff Straits of Messina, which is his account of being a Luftwaffe fighter pilot, ME-109 fighter pilot in 1943. And it's a fantastic book. I'm finding you're best off reading it. I'm best off reading it at sort of breakneck speed, because the whole thing is like this great long wired, living on these jangling nervous edges, living right on the edge of how he can endure and all that. But
you do start sweating reading it, don't you?
Yeah, you do. It's so hot. Before he gets to North Africa, because he's on the Russian front for 2 years, then he's assigned a job in North Africa. And before he goes to North Africa, he goes to a staff meeting, to look at the strategic overview of the Mediterranean campaign. And I came across this nugget that reminds me of what we were talking about. It's like he's on topic. This thing of what a division is, a battalion, the thing we ended up talking about, which is this. He says, I'd long since come to mistrust the value of the information provided by the flags and numerals on a map table. What was a battalion exactly, or a fighter squadron? No one inquired into the real combat value of these entities. A squadron was something capable of shooting down 10 of the enemy during a one-hour operation. Therefore, it had damn well got to do it. No one inquired into the actual condition of the infantry battalion whose command post was shown on the map as a small triangular flag. How could anyone tell that it was not a forlorn band, a captain and 100 men, exasperated, desperate, half out of their minds, perhaps, and with 50% of their number more or less severely wounded? Could anyone really tell?
Mm.
And you think, that's it in a nutshell, isn't it? And certainly, that's the Germans, or Hitler in particular, is looking at maps and going, oh, you know, where, I mean, you see it in Downfall, that famous parodied scene in Downfall. Where Vo is Steiner? Because he thinks there's an army. And in fact, it's a bloke's, the army consists of the bloke's headquarters,
yep.
basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that I think, is the thing we ended up talking about, didn't we? That you can still look, and Churchill as well, as you said, that time. He's guilty of this too. You see a thing on the map, you see the number, you see the name, you think, well, it's a tank division, so it's going to have this many squadrons and this many tanks. And in fact, not at all.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. It's a sort of what's on paper and what's on... well, this is half the thing about the Blitzkrieg back in 1940. You know, and it's a part of the thing about the Battle of Britain. You know, what RAF have got a very clear picture of what the Luftwaffe have got on paper.
Yeah.
But actually what they've got available to fly any, you know, at 8 a.m. every morning is quite different. It's quite interesting.
Well, and the same goes for the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe have got a clear idea of what the Luftwaffe are capable of on paper.
Yes.
You know, it's not just the RAF. It's Goering has a, you know, he's a, oh, great, we've got a, you know, last thing I know, we had 1,200 ME-109s or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he's not inquiring into their actual condition, and no one dares tell him either, I suppose.
No. What exactly
the other problem?
I mean, obviously, I can't do a podcast without mentioning the Sherwood Rangers. And at the moment, I'm, you know, I'm doing the Battle of Geel, which is a kind of sort of forgotten episode, but it was an absolutely brutal fight. You know, they lost 11 tanks there. But it's interesting because this is at the end of the Great Swan. You know, this is the end of the chase. And so suddenly, last minute, they've had a day off where they're sort of frantically kind of repairing all their tanks and everything, having done this kind of sort of 300-mile trek up through France and Belgium. And suddenly they're ordered into the firing line, and they just don't have enough because the one advantage of fighting so close to the coast, of course, in Normandy, is that their lines of supply are so short, and suddenly they've really lengthened. And so... you know, one of the guys, one of the troops is going, you know, C Squadron, which is leading the charge into Geel, has only got two complete troops. It's got two troops of three rather than troops of four. By this stage, they've moved over from three to four.
Yeah.
And it's only got kind of two lots of those. It's got one reserve, which has just got two tanks. And then it's got kind of squadron headquarters, and that's it. So basically, it's got 11, 12 tanks. Compared to the kind of normal 1920 that they should have.
Right.
And the lead guy is going in with two Fireflies. And, you know, because he just hasn't got any more.
Hasn't got the gear.
Yeah, and in his Sherman with his normal 75, the troop leader's got an ordinary Sherman. He's only got four crew, not five. They just don't have enough.
Yeah.
He hasn't got a lap gunner. And, you know, and it's just interesting. You know, you sort of think, okay, you know, such a huge run does have its impact. And again, it's one of those things that on paper, you know, and he says, I never saw more than 30 of the infantry. I reckon 30 at tops. So what's clearly happened is that the 6th DLI, the Durhams, again, in the front line, you know, they've put forward two platoons and they can probably, you know, it's probably actually more like 40 or 50 men rather than 30 that he can see.
Yeah.
But you know, it's severely under strength company attack.
Yeah.
Like 50%.
Yeah. Well, it's the wear and tear, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's the but on paper, I mean, it's fascinating. It's fascinating all that, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
and that's 50 division, and 50 division is a couple of months away from being disbanded.
Yeah. For this precise reason.
Yeah,
it's just basically withered away, isn't it? Yeah. Under the
days of plenty, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. Well, now we have, before we get started, though, although we've sort of got started there as ever, we've skedaddled all over. Richard Park, who joined August 2019, says, hi, chaps. Just a quick message to say thank you for the great podcast. As a lifelong military history buff and with many family that were in the Second World War, notably a granddad that was in the Royal Navy in the Atlantic, Pacific and Russian convoys. I also had a great uncle who was in North Africa, hospitalised by a universal Bren gun carrier, capsizing but returning to the front to take part in Operation Market Garden. I fondly remember as a boy being asked why his favourite aircraft, the Typhoon, wasn't in my Airfix Air Force. I'm currently on the front line of the NHS, and your discussions are a great tonic and distraction on my days off when I'm doing my socially distanced long walks, so I'm physically and mentally fit for action during these challenging times. Keep up the good work, Richard. Well, Richard, you keep up the good work.
Absolutely.
We're it's all right for us. We're sat in our comfy offices waffling, and you're doing something far more on point. So thank you. Thanks for getting in touch. Now we've some questions. And we'll do this one first, because actually, funnily enough, Richard just touched on this subject. Richard Park just touched on this. And Richard Traynor has a has a question for us. On Christmas Day 1943, the last major capital ship conflict came to a dramatic close in the Arctic Ocean with the sinking of the Scharnhorst. What was the effect on German morale, and how did it materially affect the Arctic convoys to the USSR?
Well, I mean, the effect on German morale is sort of irrelevant, really, because they're in a totalitarian militaristic state and morale has been shot for about 2 years already. So I don't really think it made any difference, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, but it tells the Kriegsmarine that there's nothing they can do.
No, but they've known that already. They know that already.
But it means that's why the Tirpitz is from now on holed up, unable to do anything.
Yeah.
And then the Tirpitz spends the rest of its sorry life being chased around by giant air fleets and bombers and 617 squadron and really has
shifting from one fjord to another.
Yeah, exactly. I mean the dominance in that theatre that the British have, isn't it? It's really interesting, isn't it? It's they're complete obviously, and again it gets off to that, like the Battle of the Atlantic, there are those the convoys that don't go well, that are disastrous, and then the Navy get a grip on it and the Air Force get a grip on it, and the Kriegsmarine is basically choked out of any involvement. I imagine if you're a capital ship guy in the German Navy, it's that your morale's rock bottom.
I mean, yeah, but most of those big capital ships have been that you know, there's two reasons why they're skulking in fjords. And elsewhere and in bases. The first one is, of course, because they're going to get sunk if they venture out because they just don't have enough strength. But the second thing is because they can't afford to put them out there because they haven't got enough fuel.
Yeah.
You know, they're a kind of early part of the kind of wham-bam blitzkrieg war. That's where they're supposed to play their role. And once it goes into a long, drawn-out war, they have no role, really. And you know, PQ-17, which is a notorious one that, you know, Arctic convoy that gets really, really hammered.
Yeah.
Most of the destruction is done by aircraft. It's done by the Luftwaffe rather than by any Kriegsmarine ship. So it's the fear of the Tirpitz coming out, isn't it? That's the issue. Rather than it actually emerging. I mean, in terms of that, you know, but by that point, you know, by the end of 1943, obviously loads of stuff is still going to the USSR. But you know, the crisis point has obviously changed because this is 6 months after or 5 months after Kursk. It's, you know, Germans aren't going forward anymore on the Eastern Front. It's kind of it's all over. So, I mean, I think it's really important to understand that most Germans didn't want to go to war in 1939. They were very happy when they thought it was all over by July 1940. They were then horrified to discover that it wasn't all over. And morale took a massive dip thereon. It's great that you can sort of, you know, have Die Wochenschau newsreels sort of showing how successful they're being from time to time. But basically, morale in Germany was absolutely rubbish. I mean, it was terrible. There's whole accounts of Gestapo. Basically, we have mass observation in the UK, sort of doing polls on stuff and what people's morale, but it was all completely above board. The Gestapo was doing polls on and keeping tabs on morale, but doing it clandestinely, obviously, on the sly, largely through vast armies of Stasi-like informers. And by listening in on conversations and stuff. And there's whole books on this. I mean, you know, I've got some down here. And you know, I can't remember what it's called now. But you know, morale was absolutely terrible. So, you know, the Scharnhorst being sunk is kind of like, okay, that's just another bit of shit news then, you know. But compared to Stalingrad, it's kind of, you know, who cares? I mean, I think people have sort of become inured to it by then.
Yeah, they are. I mean, the German government is well up on this. The fact that morale is completely rock bottom, and you know, the destruction of Hamburg is a big plays majorly into this, doesn't it? A major city is destroyed essentially, and there ain't nothing they could do about it. And the regime are, you know, they're worried about morale, but then of course. Whether that morale will mutate into insurrection is a different question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they're never particularly worried about that, are they?
No.
They don't get their knickers in a twist about and you know where that might lead, because after all, because you then get Goebbels saying, well, we all know what we've done together, as part of this war effort, don't we?
Yes, that's the famous, the infamous Sport Palace speech. Of, yeah. I think it's about around the 20th, 23rd of February, 1943. Yeah. So that's following the disaster of Stalingrad. And I think the thing about Stalingrad is, you know, you can argue that kind of Tunisgrad has sort of similar kind of numbers that are captured on the day and all the rest of it. But I think Stalingrad is so awful because it's the moment where the German nation realizes they are completely screwed. The psychological impact, I think the two big psychological impacts on Nazi Germany are one, Stalingrad, and two, Hamburg. And I think it's those two events above all that really make people think, holy moly, we're up the creek.
Well, yes, because, and we've talked about this before, because they know what they're doing in Russia. And if you look, you know, Russia's the front you absolutely have to win on, isn't it? If you're the Nazi state, you know, because you're going to reap what you've sown, which is basically what Goebbels then says is, he says, well, we all know what that front's been like, and we can't afford to lose on that front. Whereas, you know, as you say, Tunisgrad is
a long way away.
It's a long way away. It's not the Rassenkrieg. It's not the fight to the death with Bolshevism, with Jewish Bolshevism, and all the. It's not got the hard Nazism in it as part of a war effort, as part of the German war effort, has it? So it's got a different texture. If we're doing it from the strategic operational point of view, it is completely disastrous for the Germans. And the Mediterranean is a totally disastrous front because they're expending all that Luftwaffe effort there, who are flying around like the fire brigade from theatre to theatre, where, you know, when things start going wrong one place, they're sent there and then they all get shot down. And then they, you know, I don't know. Yes, the Scharnhorst, like you say, it's just another shit thing to happen.
Oh, well. Yeah, you know, I'd rather give it up.
Like, we're losing.
I expect most people were slightly surprised it was still afloat anyway by that stage. I mean, and then Hamburg, I think, is just so awful because it's this realization that you know, Hamburg is the second city of Germany, and I think it's the largest city in terms of population in 1943, and if it isn't, it's right up there. And you know, it is completely destroyed. I mean, it's apocalyptic. It's Armageddon, and you know, they suddenly it's this terrible realization that this is what they've got to come. You know, it's only going to get worse.
Well, it's also supposedly one of Germany's liberal cities, isn't it? Although the guy in charge is particularly he's a proper Nazi by then. But you know, it's one of the outward-looking trading cities of Germany.
Exactly,
in touch with the rest of the world and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so that it's a double blow. I mean, there is the thing that Berliners, supposedly in air raid shelters, would say, "Why aren't they bombing Munich? We didn't vote for him."
But talking of bombing, it is of course the 77th anniversary of Big Week this week.
Yes. Yes, it is, isn't it?
An underrated battle, I think.
Well, you mentioned that when we were talking about what we might discuss today. And the thing that strikes me about that is obviously it's keyed into making sure that you have air supremacy, really, rather than even superiority, air supremacy by D-Day.
Yeah.
So it's about clearing the decks. But it's February. The weather's diabolical this time of year, especially over Germany. With Big Week, was there prevarication about when to do it? Or was it a question of having the technology ready? Or was it a question of, a thing we've talked about before, where the Allies, if they could do it 9 months from now, they'd absolutely nail it first go? Or if they're doing it now because they've got to do it now because times are on, they want to get things done?
Yes.
Where does it sit?
So this sits within the bigger Operation Point Blank remit, and Point Blank is agreed at the beginning of June 1943, and it is first laid out by Ira Aker on at the Casablanca conference in January 1943.
And
Point Blank is to prioritize the degradation of the air force of the Luftwaffe, because first of all, if you do that, then you're clearing the skies over Europe, which means you have much more flexibility about what you want to do with the second front, i.e. Normandy. And the second thing about that is, the less Luftwaffe, the easier it is to bomb, which means your bombing is then more effective. So if you prioritise destroying the Luftwaffe first, then you can get on with everything else you want to do. And actually, this is incredibly sensible, and you know, it's hard not to agree with it. The difference, of course, is that you know, what Bomber Command says is, yeah, but you know, we can't really destroy the Luftwaffe by night, and you know, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And the Americans go, yeah, you can just destroy factories and stuff. You know, that will destroy the Luftwaffe. So anyway, it sort of rages, and Harris pays lip service to it and does go along with it, but only kind of sort of begrudgingly. But it is absolutely the key policy behind what the Mighty Eighth is doing, and what growing strategic air forces are doing in Italy as well. And suddenly, though, in the autumn, it's not going quite as well as the Americans would have had hoped. And there is this mounting panic that, shite, you know, we're in a situation that we're planning D-Day for May 1944, which is what they're doing in 1943. And without having air supremacy over a whole swathe of Northwest Europe, we are in big shtuck, because that is our biggest fear, is being hammered by the Luftwaffe as we're trying to land on D-Day. And it is just a kind of total non-negotiable prerequisite that we have control of the skies over Northwest Europe.
Because after all, control of the skies in 1940 is the thing that's emblematic with tactical success on the ground, isn't it?
Totally. And it's absolutely non-negotiable. And the timetable is starting to look a bit icky, you know, because there is no sign at all in the latter half of 1940, you know, in the late summer, early autumn of 1943, that this is happening. So everyone's thinking, well, what are we going to do? And the big problem is that the Flying Fortress is not quite the fortress that everyone had assumed it would be, and that daylight bombing without being escorted by fighters is a problem. The problem they've got is that fighters, because they're smaller, have smaller fuel tanks, which means they don't go so far, which means they can't escort bombers deep into the Reich. But quite sensibly, where the Reich has put most of its Luftwaffe factories are deep, not close to the west.
Yeah.
So it's fine. You can get to Bremen, and you can get to Wilhelmshaven, and you can get to various, you know, places in the Ruhr without escorted, and that's not big drama. But the moment you want to go to Schweinfurt or Regensburg or Posen or Rostock or Brunswick or any of these other places, which is where and Leipzig, which is where most of the and Augsburg, which is where most of the Luftwaffe aircraft factories are, you're in for really big hammering. And there's a couple of times they go to Schweinfurt where they and also to Regensburg, where the daylight bombers just get absolutely hammered. We were talking about morale just a moment ago, and that is starting to have a massive impact on the effectiveness of the Mighty Eighth, and indeed Bomber Command as well. You know, you just can't do this. You're getting hammered. And so the race is on to try and find this long-range fighter that can take them all the way deep into Germany. And that is suddenly becomes the number one top priority the US Army Air Force. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's a new aircraft, whether it's an adapted aircraft, whatever it is, sort it out. And that those instructions are given out in the summer of 1943 with this sort of growing concern, because I think that, you know, because of the first Schweinfurt raid.
That raid is a complete catastrophe, isn't it? I mean, it's really no other way of looking at it.
20% of them are shot down.
Yeah, Schweinfurt, Regensburg raids are you know, that they're sort of, in a way, they kind of they remind me of Bomber Command's efforts in 1940, where they press home attacks anyway in daylight and get an absolute kicking. And Bomber Command conclude from that, well, this, we're not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
We're going to fly by night now. This ain't worth it. So it's interesting that the Americans, rather than saying, all right, then we'll switch to night flying, which must have been the advice they were getting from Harris and from other players. Well, switch to night bombing, and you won't run into anything like this problem. But that they're sticking with daylight's very interesting, because it also ties into it also because the story of the Americans, you know, the British and the American approach to strategic bombing, in effect, end up the same thing, but are very different in their approach, aren't they? Because I mean, we talked about Hamburg a moment ago. The Americans are part of the Hamburg raids, but they're doing it by daylight, and they bomb the ports. And so the RAF are going to Hamburg every night and literally setting fire to the centre of the city. And the Americans send their planes to bomb the port, to bomb the harbour, the port facilities, and miss. And because the Americans are precision bombing, so they miss their targets. The British are like, we're not particularly interested in being precise. We're interested in hammer, colossal cracks. I mean, it's almost like it's that idea. Yeah. that hammer blows, massive morale or effects-based operations, which is the modern name for it, where you strike a blow to show the enemy who's boss, as much as anything else, is what Hamburg's about.
Yeah.
But the Americans have got themselves, and you know, with the Norden bombsight, which we've talked about before, got themselves into this idea that they can bomb accurately. Of course, they can't, and the weather means they can't. So what Big Week turns into, effectively, isn't you send the bombers up. They're not bait as such, are they? But once you've got the fighter cover worked out, or are they? Are they bait? Is it really that actually the cart's before the horse here? That the idea of Big Week is to act like you're bombing Germany, but draw the Luftwaffe into a decisive battle. Is that what's going on? Right.
It's absolutely both. So the operation argument, which is what Big Week becomes, is first mooted in November. And they say, right, you know, we'll do this. We'll have this concentration. We'll have this mass concentration. Even though they don't have the long range fighter in November. And they say, you know, we will do this just as soon as there's a weather gap. And so urgent is it that we'll just do it. You know, and even if we take the losses, we're just going to have to take that on the chin because we've got to do this all our effort to try and try them. And the point is that what they know is that the moment they go and bomb Luftwaffe factories, swarms of Luftwaffe fighter planes come to defend it. So you're killing two birds with one stone. You're hitting the factories, but you're also destroying the Luftwaffe in the air. So that's the twin point of it. And it's just there isn't a weather window to enact a sustained week of heavy bombing. Until the third week of February 1944.
Yeah.
But coincidentally, by that time, they do have two fighter groups of Mustangs. And it's the Mustang, which is first developed in 1940, which is commissioned by the British, by the RAF, which goes into RAF service, but which is transformed with putting in a Merlin 61 engine.
Yeah.
And the reason this is done is because Ron Harker, who's the chief test pilot for Rolls-Royce, recognises that he's always liked the Mustang a lot, and he recognises that at similar power levels, so this is horsepower, the Merlin 61, the Mustang can go faster than the Spitfire Part 5 by 35 miles an hour. So therefore, he reckons it's quite a good punt to put a Merlin 61 into the Mustang and whip out the old Allison engine, which is a bit of a dog.
Yeah.
And it completely transforms it. So instead of because what was happening with the Allison engine was the Mustang was getting slower the higher it went. So it then ended up being a ground attack aircraft. Whereas when you put the Merlin 61 in, it gets faster the higher you go. So it starts off at being, you know, it can fly at kind of 375 miles an hour at 5,000 feet, but it can do 400 at 10,000 feet. And at 20,000 feet, it can do 430 miles an hour. But at 35,000 feet, it can do 455 miles an hour. And above 28,000 feet, it can fly 70 miles an hour faster than the fastest German aircraft they have at the time, which is a Messerschmitt 109G and the Focke Wulf 190. So when you consider that height and speed are two huge advantages, the higher you go up, and also it can roll faster than anything else. So it is a truly amazing aircraft. And once you put in drop tanks, which are these made out of sort of, you know, like MDF. You make these drop tanks with 75 gallons on each wing and a further 75 gallon tank in the fuselage. Once you put those in, it can then travel kind of 1,475 miles, which gets you beyond Berlin and back again. And that is a total game changer. And that is...
Tell you what.
Yeah, go on.
We're going to take a break and you can tell us about the game changer after the break. There you go. It's a cliffhanger for you, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, there you go.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. I asked James to hold a thought there, so it's a game changer. I've a question though. Why are there not Spitfires with drop tanks on escorting doing this job?
That's such a good question, and it's a source of enormous frustration. And it probably won't surprise you that a lot of this is down to my old friend Lee Mallory, the man who I think is the most undeserving Air Chief Marshal of all.
Does he not buy it?
Well, so we have had drop tanks on Spitfires, because otherwise how did they get to Malta, for example, taking off from Eagle and Wasp and all the rest of it?
Yeah.
You know, so it's perfectly capable of it. And, you know, again, you know, a Spitfire when it's flying, that's why you have PR Spitfires that can fly to Berlin and take photographs of them. So they're perfectly capable of doing it. The point is because they are operating at, Bomber Command is predominantly operating at night, there is simply no requirement for a daylight fighter. And the Americans don't go to the British and go, please can we have some Spitfires which you convert to long range? They just don't do it, you know, because the conversation in the summer of 1943 is basically in July 1943. So the Schweinfurt raid hasn't happened at this point, but Hap Arnold, who is the commander in chief of the United States Army Air Force, says to Barney Giles, who is his number two, says, we have to get a long range fighter. I don't care how you get it. I don't care whether whether it's an existing plane or whatever, or a completely brand new model, just sort it out and I need it in 6 months' time. You know, but by the end of the year, I need to have long range fighters that can go all the way deep into the Reich. So at the time, Barney Giles is sort of going, you know, obviously going to the RAF and saying, could we have a whole load of Spitfires that we turn into long range fighters is an option. It absolutely is an option. But there's another option which is sitting under his nose, which is the Mustang, which is already, because the previous October is when Ron Harker has suggested putting a Merlin 61. So in October 1942, they've worked out that with a Merlin 61 in it, the Mustang is just totally transformed. So rather than go to a British aircraft, they go, well, hang on a minute, let's exhaust our options here. Let's have a look at whether the Mustang can carry this kind of load. So they go off to the good folk at North America and start doing all these tests with extra fuel tanks. So first of all, you know, because Mustang's quite a small plane, incredibly high wind loading and all the rest of it. And the worry is that it just won't have the strength to kind of take that much extra fuel. So the first thing they do is they put a 75-gallon tank in the fuselage and they go, okay, well, let's take off and see what happens. It takes off absolutely fine. And the centre of
gravity. Oh, that works fine, does it?
Absolutely fine, no problem at all. And so then they kind of think, okay, well, let's couple of, you know, either wing, let's put a couple of drop tanks. And they sort of go up in increments. And they discover that actually they can have an extra 150 gallons under the wings, in addition to the 75. So suddenly you've got 225 extra gallons that you didn't have beforehand, plus the Merlin 61, which is now being built under license as a Packard.
By Packard, yeah.
Yeah, and suddenly it's doing it. So it's not that the Spitfires don't do it. It's just that there is no requirement from the RAF really to mass produce long-range Spitfires. The performance of the Mustang is superior to that of a.
You see that? That's really interesting, isn't it? Because the RAF in 1941, the Fighter Command, you know, for want of something to do, gets into this idea of rhubarbing over northern France, going out, attracting the Luftwaffe's attention, shooting fighters down, and trying to do sort of general attriting on the Luftwaffe. But there's not a movement to do that. To go into maraud in German airspace with drop tanks on and go and cause trouble, is there?
No, none at all. The whole rhubarbing thing is just a terrible, terrible idea. And
I know. I know. But it's interesting that there isn't a thought to do that, to take that to Germany. I suppose it's been disproved. It's been proved to be a complete waste of men and machines and basically a daft thing to do.
Most of those Spitfires should have been sent straight to where the action is, which is the Middle East.
Yeah, And anyway, by 1943-44, I mean, in the run up to D-Day, you've got Spitfires in ground attack roles dealing with prospective V weapon sites and all that sort of stuff too, haven't you?
Yep. Yeah. So they're shooting up stuff on the ground.
That's what the RAF are doing, is shooting up stuff on the ground, or the fighter bit at least. I remember, you look at it, you think, surely there are hundreds of thousands of Spitfires kicking around that you could stick tanks on and this problem would have been solved earlier. But I suppose it's also that thing of the USAF, they want to do it themselves, don't they, as well? They want to run this show themselves.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why they don't go into the nighttime attacks. First of all, they just feel that their strategy of targeting... So the whole point-blank strategy, which is to target as a number one priority the Luftwaffe, really probably does need, in 1943, certainly, does require daylight operations, because, you know, nighttime operations aren't accurate enough for the Americans in 1943. Yeah. That all changes in 1944, when actually there's no real difference in accuracy between daylight and nighttime bombing. Such are the advancements of navigation aids and all the rest of it. But there is a second reason, which is that the US Army Air Force wants to become the US Air Force. And it wants independence, and it wants the same thing, and it doesn't want to be kind of sort of, you know, piggybacking on the RAF Bomber Command. And also there is this other advantage that means you can then bomb round the clock. There's just no let up, which obviously is more effective than everyone sort of, you know, filling up the airspace of just in the hours of darkness. And of course, all this has been decided in summer when the hours of darkness are quite short and the days are long and all the rest of it. So you can, there's a whole host of reasons which come into it. But it then, but as a result of that, the consequence of not having the daylight, the long range fighters, by not having that, by that, that sense of growing panic and urgency to absolutely smash the Luftwaffe as quickly as they possibly can, means that although it's winter, although the weather's appalling, although there's lots of cloud cover, and although daylight hours are short, just the moment there is an opportunity, they've got to take the ultimate risk and just go for it. And that's why Big Week finally happens on the third week of February. And, you know, it is an enormous battle. If you basically accept that Big Week is an air battle all of its own,
then
the numbers are just absolutely staggering.
Well, how do they compare to the Battle of Britain then?
Oh, just
Vickers Tea Party stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in 1 week, 3,300 bombers from the Mighty Eighth, 500 from the 15th Air Force, and 2,750 from Bomber Command. That's just the bombers.
Bloody hell!
Yeah, you know, so I mean, let's give one example. For example, let's see. You know, you're talking about, you know, on the final day of Big Week, which is Friday the 25th, 900 8th Air Force bombers hit Regensburg and Augsburg, supported by 595 RAF bombers and around 700 fighter planes.
And the Luftwaffe simply can't leave that unanswered, can they? That's the point, isn't
they
it?
They don't, and they get absolutely slaughtered. I mean, the figures of losses in the Luftwaffe, actually in the last 4 months of 1943, so this is before Big Week, is just staggering and shows just how much they're being degraded. So the problem with the Luftwaffe is that they've still got the numbers, but they haven't got the quality. So they haven't got quality aircraft. They certainly haven't got quality pilots anymore.
Pilots,
so they lose, from between August and December 1943, on the Western Front, they lose 967 pilots shot down and 1,052 lost without any help from the Allies whatsoever. And actually, what's really interesting is that kind of 55% accidents and pilot error to 45% shot down continues in Big Week and into 1944.
And that's a barometer for how inexperienced these pilots are, how poorly trained they are, and, you know.
Completely. So January 1944, 1,766 planes are lost. In February, that's 2,605. In March, it's 2,612. In April 1944, it's 3,619. Of which, of that, roughly 55% are training and accident losses, and 45% are down to enemy action. So the biggest culprit in shooting down in losing the losses of aircraft are the Luftwaffe themselves, because they're inadequately trained and they're flying incredibly complex and difficult aircraft for which they're just simply not qualified to do, and they're just
and the pressure they're under, they haven't got time to train people quickly enough. The accidents will also be pilots who've been up two or three times a day, you know, and this is an example of, because we've talked about in the Battle of Britain the home advantage of the fighter command, that because they're under such pressure, that force multiplier isn't coming to bear for the Luftwaffe. This also plugs into the question of, was the strategic bombing campaign effective?
Yes.
Because what we end up with is that, you know, I think it was Philips Pesnebrot says, well, what total military production is going into tanks, whatever, in 1944? It's, what is it, 7%? 7%. What is it, 45% of the German industrial effort is going into fighter defence.
Yeah.
Now, if your enemy is spending almost half of his industrial effort on the strategic bomber offensive, the strategic bomber offensive is extremely effective.
Yeah. If those figures were literally full stop, isn't it? I mean, you know,
It's unarguable. If the numbers were the other way round, you'd have reason to go, well, I don't know if the strategic bombing campaign's working, wouldn't you?
Yep.
You'd be able to say the Germans clearly aren't bothered by it. But those numbers tell you that the Germans are incredibly bothered by it existentially, if half their effort's going into it. And after all, I can't remember, is it half the British effort's going into building Lancasters as well? So you know, the seriousness with which the two things are taken by the two economies show you, I cannot remember that number, but it's a vast number that's of British industrial effort that's going into building Lancasters, for instance. But I mean, there's the full stop there is the 45% on fighters, isn't it?
It's absolutely amazing because, I mean, if you're a fighter pilot and you are joining, you know, and it's let's say you join your frontline unit in January 1944, if you're in the RAF and the USAAF and you're a fighter pilot, you're getting about 350 hours before you join. The moment you get there, and particularly the American squadrons are so oversubscribed to the number. So they would have 16 aircraft in the air, four flights of four, finger fours, up in the air for any one operation, of which they've probably got about 40, 45 pilots. So when you first arrive as a greenhorn, you've got 350 hours. So you know your way around a plane, no problem at all. What you don't know, what you don't have is combat experience, which is everything.
Yeah.
So to start off with, you're not going to be sent off on a mission. You'll have a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, beetling around. You've got God knows how much fuel. Yes. You've got God knows how many aircraft. None of these things are a shortage. So you then get taken up by some of the old hands. You know, you're given kind of, you know, the old bit of training with a veteran, shown some of the ropes, and then you go on a milk run, you know, little one over to France or whatever, just get a little fail of it. And you build up to the big one. You build up to Berlin or whatever it might be. And so by the time you're actually going into combat, you are really honed. Whereas a German fighter pilot by January 1944 has barely got 100 hours in his logbook and is flung straight into it and just gets shot down. I mean, it's like First World War stuff. And they've got no chance, because how can you possibly compete when you bet you're still kind of thinking about, you know, where am I going? What am I doing? What do I do about boost? You know, you're still thinking about how to fly. It means you haven't got any time to think about how to be a combat flyer. And the two things are kind of different. And the whole thing is just completely throws you, because suddenly when you're in combat zone, you're doing things with an aircraft that you never thought were possible when you're training.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of the time, these guys are not even shot down. They're in the middle of a dogfight and they've done something that they can't get out of, because suddenly the plane's gone out of control because they pushed it too hard, and then down they go. You know, so it is totally lambs to the slaughter. I mean, having said that, though, Big Week was very costly for the Allies as well. I mean,
yes. So what are the Allied losses?
Well, you know, they lose 266 bombers, which is 2,600 aircrew. RAF Bomber Command loses 157 bombers, which, because they've only got seven in them and not ten, is 1,000 aircrew. But it's, you know, these are really significant losses, and representative of the fact that this is a massive all out effort.
So what are the relative rates of attrition then? What the Luftwaffe, what's their rate of attrition in Big Week?
Well, they lose 2,600 aircraft in
of how many?
Well, about 4,000, you know. But they're losing 50%.
Yeah, and the Allies are losing what, 10%?
Yeah.
The thing is, you can't afford to lose 10% very long.
Well, they're not. They're losing, you know, the US in total, they're losing, you know, 266 bombers of any one time. That's 25%. But they haven't got much more than about 1,000 bombers.
Yeah.
But they're replacing them very, very quickly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But they're replacing them with properly trained crew. That's the difference. So the Luftwaffe are not replacing them quite as much as they want. They're about 75% of production. And Big Week knocks them out, reduces production by about 35% for about 6 to 8 weeks, something like that. Which, on the scheme of things, doesn't sound like an awful lot, but it's just that it's the attrition of air crew that really, really counts more than anything else. And the bottom line is if you are smashing aircraft factories in Leipzig and Augsburg and Regensburg and all the rest of it, and knocking out, you know, huge hangars and stuff, that is a massive pain in the arse for the Luftwaffe. It does make their life.
You're also slowing all of that down as well.
Completely. And the bottom line is, Big Week works because by the middle of April 1945, the Allies have got air supremacy over much of Northwest Europe, which is absolutely the stated goal. And which then means they can do all the stuff that they need to do in preparation for D-Day, i.e. blow up bridges over the Seine and hit marshalling guards at Ham and, you know, all those sort of things, and Rouen and Reims and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Which you couldn't do if you didn't have control of the skies, because you have those bridges and things have to be bombed at much lower altitudes by medium bombers rather than heavy bombers. And you can only do that when you've got control of the skies, otherwise you're going to be pounced on, shot out of the sky, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, and the Germans, in the end, by using V weapons, demonstrate that, conventional air power has run out of road for them.
Yeah.
That they have to resort to, you know, extraordinary technology because it's just not working. And
as you've discovered from reading Pierre Klosterman and the Big Show, you know, the last 6 months of the war were brutal in the air. You know, and you've got ME-262s and Comets and loads and loads of ground flak and, you know, I mean, 15,000 anti-aircraft guns in the Reich alone.
Yes, it's the flak more than anything else that features in Klosterman's books far more than enemy fighters. You don't need to be as experienced to fire a flat gun, do you? As well trained as a pilot, it's more effective, isn't it?
I definitely want to do. I'm really up for doing a book on the last 6 months of the war in the air. I just think it'd be so good.
So, would you say that
Mustangs? No, absolutely. ME-262s.
So, would you say that Big Week is one of the, you know, like if because it's no one's heard of it if aside from your excellent book, if you wanted to plug it, James.
No, I wouldn't dream of doing such a thing. It's so vulgar as plugging a book on a podcast.
A terrible thing to do. But is it one of the great battles of the, you know, because after all, people don't really know, if people know anything about the strategic bombing campaign, I mean, outside of the afflicted, they know about Dresden. They may know about the Dam's raids. I don't know if they've heard of the Dam's raids. You know what I mean? Like the headline bombing events are probably Dresden, Dam's raids, maybe Hamburg.
Yeah.
Because after all, you can't talk about Dresden if you don't talk about Hamburg. The relevance of Dresden without knowing that Hamburg happened 2 years prior to that doesn't really add up, I think, as an assessment of Dresden. Why is Big Week not sort of, because it's one of the decisive battles of 1944, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, but I think when it comes to the air war, I think most people think that the RAF Bomber Command just sort of arrived fully formed sometime early stages of the war with Lancasters, and then they were just bombing, and that happened, and it was just relentless, and then the Americans turned up with their flying fortresses, and that just happened too. Yeah. And I think what people don't realise is the kind of the ebbs and flows and the folds of it all, and how it all worked out, and the crises that hit both the Luftwaffe and the Allies, and how it kind of pan forth. And actually, the whole narrative arc of the strategic air campaign is absolutely fascinating. Big Week is largely forgotten. And I think it's because, yet again, it's sort of superseded by D-Day and what followed and all the rest of it. But I think it is really, really significant. I think it is really important. It's the first big combined round-the-clock major air battle, you know, single offensive that takes place. And in terms of kind of, you know, a single air battle, if you consider it as a single air battle, which certainly the Allies did at the time, it is the biggest, I mean, in terms of numbers. And it's such an important marker because by the end of February 1944, they are almost winning. You know, they've almost won. It has pretty much done what it needs to do. And, you know, 6 weeks later, it's all over for the Luftwaffe. Yeah. And the conditions in which D-Day and Operation Overlord can go ahead have been met, and you know, it doesn't get more important than that.
Yeah.
You know, when you're looking at D-Day, you really do need to look at the air battle that precedes it. So I always I don't want to plug my books, but I'm going to. But Big Week and Normandy 44 really go together much better in a way than Sicily 43 and Normandy 44.
Well, I mean, as a pair of battles. So if it's Big Week and D-Day, then it's the Battle of Britain and Sea Lion. They're the equivalent. Yeah. They're the equivalent operational battles, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because the Battle of Britain sets out to do what Big Week achieves, and look at what it takes to make Big Week work.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It basically takes four years of figuring out that's how you do it. I mean, it's the other, as you say about the bomber offensive is, when you look at the, you know, 1945 and the sort of free reign that the Allied bombers have, that's been extremely hard won, and isn't a constant or a thing that you can at all say is, oh, like you say, oh, the bomber commander set up, they got Lancasters, everything's fine. That's been chipped away at And they have a very... The second half of 43 after Hamburg is terrible. The battle for Berlin is essentially disastrous. Mm. And the bomber command unravels pretty much in the second half of 43.
Well, it's largely because the Luftwaffe gets its act together very, very quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
It completely changes its control system, its command and control system. Yeah. So, you know, so the air defence system that Britain comes up, the Downing system that's in place for the Battle of Britain by 1940, you know, that's been really, really fought through. Whereas the German air defence system, because they just attack and they don't defend, right? You know, that's what they do. Yeah. They haven't thought about an air defence system, so it just doesn't exist. Yeah. So it evolves much more organically. But by the second half of 1943, it is really, really good. And it's got all the best bits of the Downing system, but with slightly more sophisticated tech. It's first rate, and their kind of night fighting operations work. So this is one of the things that the bomber command gets more accurate in its bombing, but at the same token, it becomes more dangerous for them to operate at night because the air defence system around Germany is more effective. I mean, you know, we've done an awful lot in the last 20 minutes of just talking about statistics and numbers and all the rest of it. But I think the other thing that's so amazing about this period is, blimey, talk about human drama. I mean, you know, the individual stories, whether it's kind of Heinz Nocker kind of, you know, keeping, you know, continually being shot down in his Messerschmitt, or whether it's some of these bomber crews. I mean, goodness me. The kind of, you know, I remember when I was writing Big Week and just sort of sweating and getting the shakes just from having to kind of write down what these guys were going through and what they're witnessing and what they're seeing and just how taut your nerves would be going on these missions. I mean, you know, it is, you know, skill and experience can help you, but ultimately there's a hell of a lot of lottery involved in whether you're going to come back or not. And they all know that, and they know that the odds are against them, and they keep getting into their B-17s, well, they keep getting into their Lancasters and keep going. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing.
There's the irony, isn't there, that as Bomber Command get better at getting to places, the Germans are getting better at defending them. So you will find your way to Berlin, and that, of course, where you have an increased chance of being shot down.
Absolutely.
Whereas the year it's before where you
terrifying.
Might get the year before where you might get lost and they were no good at shooting you down.
Yeah.
It's probably a better set of circumstances. The ironies abound. Well, I think we've probably covered that. That's it for today. We're back Thursday with Jonathan Ware, and then live streaming Thursday, and that's a great chat. And then we're live streaming Thursday night at 8:30 p.m. UK time. Keep your family stories coming too, and don't forget there's a daily short video on the Patreon site with James and I chewing the cud over a photo from the Second World War. Thank you very much for listening. Big Week by James Holland was out the year before last. See you soon. Bye.
Cheerio.